From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, an organization works to revitalize inner-city Milwaukee. Later, a photographer uses pictures to get us to look past mere images.
To kind of put some of those other feelings aside, instead of prejudging somebody, beginning to get an understanding beyond what you see visually.
Ray Pfister looks back at how producing 100 wine podcasts has changed him.
I don't drink wine the same way. I don't see it the same way. Now that I know what these people go through, what they deal with, from Mother Nature to what could happen in the cellar, I have such a different appreciation for it.
And as the World Series gets underway, a Milwaukee writer looks at what makes Red Sox fans distinctive. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We've all heard the negative stereotypes of inner-city Milwaukee as a place in crisis. Violent crime, high rates of foreclosures, problems with drugs are all often linked with the city. While there are unquestionably problems facing our communities, those issues don't tell the full story, and that's where LISC Milwaukee comes in. The local chapter of the national group, the Local Initiative Support Corporation, wants to break down those perceptions and help revitalize distressed neighborhoods. By bringing together community partners and taking key policymakers on tours through the five communities they work in, LISC is showing off what's to love about Milwaukee. Christopher Boston is Director of Sustainable Communities for LISC Milwaukee. Dawn Hutchison Weiss is Director of Communications there, and they tell Lake Effect Stephanie Lutche more about what they're doing.
I think there is a significant misperception about what's going on in the city, who lives in the city, what kind of people, what kind of neighborhoods, what kind of families, what kind of businesses are operating here. And I have to quote my boss. He says, you know, I think a lot of people believe, you know, Milwaukee is a cesspool of decay and despair, and it's really not the case. And I think that our work is moving more and more into helping to educate people about, you know, the real people who are working hard every day to improve the quality of life in their neighborhoods. And I know we've been doing a lot of bus tours and a lot of outreach. We've been developing an honorary board because the truth is that for Milwaukee to succeed, we need the investment of the broader Southeast region and the state, really. We're doing more and more to help educate legislators and thought leaders outside of the city and, you know, ask them to invest, ask them to advocate, and just to get to know what's really happening here.
What are some of the examples that you highlight in these bus tours and the outreach work that you do that's really changing perceptions?
I would say we confront them. We just confront them, and the best way to confront them is to get people on a bus, to get them in the neighborhood, and to get them in front of the individuals who are working to transform these places. Then I think they get a sense of really what's taking place, and they understand. The individuals in those neighborhoods want the same things they want. They want safer streets. They want better schools. They want homes that reflect the kind of lifestyle that they'd like to live. Then I think you can see, in some instances, a light bulb go off in their mind where they're like, wow. Sometimes they say things like, I never knew all of these things were happening in this neighborhood. I mean, how many places can you go, like Lindsay Heights neighborhood, where you have the largest peach orchard in the state of Wisconsin and then the best corned beef, all within one block? You can't go to a neighborhood like Clark Square that has the asset of the Mitchell Park domes, but then also in that same park is where you have some really extensive youth programming and one of the largest elementary schools in the state of Wisconsin at Henry Longfellow School. You know, what about going to a place like Washington Park? You know, a lot of times people don't recognize that the park itself within Washington Park is actually where we used to have our zoo. A lot of people don't recognize that the park that was designed in Washington Park was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted, who also designed Central Park. You have two of Milwaukee's oldest anchors in Miller Brewing Company and Harley Davidson, located really within that neighborhood. And if you get to these places, you'll see all that's taking place in these neighborhoods that really speak to what we can be in this city.
So how do you walk that line between not wanting to gloss over the realities of the challenges these neighborhoods may be facing with highlighting the positive stories that are going on there?
So let me just reference a couple of different things. You know, one, I come out of a community organizing tradition, and There's a thought in community organizing tradition which speaks to the world as it is and the world as it should be. And it's sort of founded on a theological perspective that speaks of the already and the not yet. In many ways, our neighborhoods and our cities are in between those places, the world as it is and the world as it should be, the already and the not yet. We already have talented individuals who live in these neighborhoods, compassionate individuals who look out for one another as residents, and passionate individuals who lead with the perspective to change and transform these neighborhoods. But, you know, they're not yet what they should be. They're still issues of crime and violence in the neighborhoods in some instances. There's still issues of large amounts of unemployment within the neighborhoods. And in some instances, there are issues where there's some hopelessness that exists within these neighborhoods. But what we've experienced is that the compassion that the leaders have who work to address the issues in these neighborhoods far exceeds the challenges that these neighborhoods present.
LISC's work focuses on trying to build the infrastructure of a neighborhood to better support itself. And so I think in the tours and when we talk to people, we try to highlight that aspect of the work. You know, the fundamental work that we do with each of our neighborhoods is to help them develop a quality of life plan, which takes anywhere from 6 months to a year to develop. And it's a process of bringing residents together, sharing their hopes, their aspirations, their challenges. And a lot of very serious issues come out at these meetings, obviously. And so that process of helping a neighborhood organize itself and come up with a common set of priorities that they can agree upon and putting it to paper and creating a very specific plan for their future is very powerful. And they use that as a roadmap for investment and buy-in and engagement in their neighborhood. A lot of the work that we do is also around making connections because, you know, we're working in some of the most disenfranchised communities, you know, in our city, but in some ways in the country. So, and part of that characteristic of some of these neighborhoods is a lack of connection to resources and assets and technical support. So LISC is really uniquely positioned because we have very strong relationships with lenders and the private sector and the city of Milwaukee, as well as with community leaders. So we can play a really unique role in helping, you know, investors connect up with projects that are really going to make a big difference in driving change in the neighborhoods, and then also helping the neighborhood partners connect up with resources to fulfill their, you know, dreams and plans.
As we quote our executive director, Leo Reese, he likes to describe our work as convening but not controlling. We like to set the table and bring people to the table. But what gets put on the table is determined by them. There are individuals who are in the kitchen who we think are much better cooks and much better chefs than we are. And the things that they put on the table we think are going to be much better if they do it than versus we do it. But we do feel like that it's our responsibility to set the table.
Well, so tell us about some of the successes that you've had. Where have you seen some of these connections been made? And where have you been able to really change minds?
Well, we can go over a series of examples. One, again, in Washington Park in that neighborhood. The lead agency in that neighborhood is United Methodist Children's Services, an organization that's been around for 40 years, providing resources to women and children, particularly women who are aging out of foster care. You know, as we began to engage them in conversation, we learned that they had a desire and aspiration to do much more than what they were doing, which was great work. They had transformed the lives of thousands of young women within this area, within this city. But they really began to see that their work was fundamentally, they were really working for something bigger. As they talked to us, we began to really assess what it is they really wanted to do. And from that standpoint, they went from being, you know, a social service provider in the neighborhood to a provider of affordable housing in the neighborhood and supportive housing for those same women who were transitioning out of foster care and transitioning out of their transitional living into more permanent housing. And so they were able to acquire land within that neighborhood, demolish some homes, and then build scattered site townhomes within the neighborhood. And then they had three apartment development projects within that neighborhood. And if you look in that neighborhood now, you can see the change that takes place really speaks to the neighborhood's aspirations and really its future. And that all happened based on a conversation. And so you begin to connect the dots. And then with that, you begin to see other people investing within the neighborhood. In the next couple of years, you're going to see a new clinic within that neighborhood by Progressive Health Centers. You're also going to see increased investment from other institutions. Habitat for Humanity is going to build 120 new homes within that neighborhood in the next 3 to 5 years. And so that transformation takes place all by one conversation. And then as you bring people together, you begin to see these changes take place in real tangible ways.
You know, we've been working with Washington Park neighborhood for about 7 years. And if you ask residents in that neighborhood, they say that they can feel a difference. You know, they feel like there's forward momentum. And Habitat for Humanity chose to announce this, you know, $20 million commitment to that neighborhood very specifically because that neighborhood is well organized now.
I would imagine, though, that there are occasionally setbacks. How do you make sure that the message you're trying to get out and these connections you're trying to build continue in the face of a setback?
The individuals who are working in the neighborhoods where we work recover very effectively and in some ways very quickly. And one example we have is an incident of violence that happened in May of this year. It was about 2.5 weeks after we celebrated the release of our new community safety initiative and our partnership with the Milwaukee Police Department in Washington Park itself, with a lot of fanfare and media coverage. And just 2.5 weeks later, in an area that had been revitalized to be a new play space for young people in the northern part of the neighborhood, there was a homicide. But what happened was an immediate response, not to say this is just something that we have to deal with, but to say, we understand that this is a challenge, but the neighborhood is still growing. We understand that this is a challenge, but the Milwaukee Police Department is working with individuals on the ground to deal with the challenge that this issue presents, and also to understand the context of the matter. And that is, while that neighborhood still had some challenges in terms of crime and some violence, that the Milwaukee Police Department had been working very effectively to pinpoint the issues of violence. And really, their data speaks to that there's a small subset of criminal actors within the neighborhood that are doing most of that criminal activity. If they could focus their efforts on those individuals, the rest of the neighborhood that wants it to be a safer place can work towards that goal. The point is, we're working together to change perceptions because we understand that a story like this can really do a lot of damage to the overall progress of an initiative. But if we continue to focus on the growth, the evolution, and the hope that exists within the neighborhood, then we think that we can do great things to change perceptions and really get people to understand that these are vibrant places and spaces that have a whole lot of rhythm.
It seems so simple, but it's almost like the lengths that a conversation alone can go, that engaging and talking with people can have such an impact in and of itself.
I think that's sometimes why our work is hard to explain, because a lot of the work that we do has to do with building relationships. And I know, to quote Leo again, we're going to give him a big head, but you know, when things get tough, sometimes in relationships that we're working with internally, you know, he'll say that is the work. That is the work of, that we're doing. It's to try and build bridges across groups and people and build collaboration and build understanding.
Milwaukee's neighborhoods are a treasure chest of hope, activity, assets, information, and just wonderful people. And I think that as we continue to look at all that's happening within our neighborhoods and find ways to connect these neighborhoods with the broader economic agenda, I think in the end, we will have a much better product and we'll have a much stronger narrative as we look back on all the work that took place to transform our city. The individuals that work in the neighborhoods where we are working and are tremendous individuals. Individuals who will not leave no matter how tough it gets. They will continue to roll up their sleeves and fight for change and fight for transformation and fight for the residents that are in their neighborhood. And that, I think, is special. It really is one of the things that keeps us going on a daily basis, is because they won't quit. And because they won't quit, we can't quit. There's a lot to do. Cities are very complex systems. You know, the change that we seek will not take place overnight. There's no silver bullet. There's no easy solution. It will take a lot of work, but it will take all of us working together in order to lift our city.
Christopher Boston and Dawn Hutchinson-Weiss, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about LISC Milwaukee.
Thanks for having us, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Christopher Boston is Director of Sustainable Communities for LISC Milwaukee. Dawn Hutchinson-Weiss is Director of Communications. They spoke with Stephanie Lecce. You can find out more about the group's second annual community development symposium called Whole Neighborhoods, One Milwaukee, scheduled for this Saturday from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Photographer William Zubik explores the complex issue of our identity in a new exhibit opening this week. We'll learn more after a break on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. We've all heard the cliche, don't judge a book by its cover. And even if we don't think we're doing it, we often are. And people are judging us by the way we seemingly express ourselves through our cars, our clothing, tattoos, the food we eat, many more things. Photographer William Zubik starts with imagery, but his new exhibit and accompanying publication explore the issue of just who we are. It's called Identity, and the show runs Saturdays, beginning this weekend at the Frank Juarez Gallery in Sheboygan. The exhibit features clothed and nude pictures of models of various body types and genders, along with a statement from each about themselves. Zubik tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon what got him thinking about these issues.
Well, the Identity Project came to me actually early on, probably over 10 years ago, in the form of basically a flirtatious poem that I had written. When you're like behind somebody at a stoplight and you're looking at the car in front of you and you see the reflection of their eyes in their rearview mirror, a lot of things come up as to, you know, who this person is, what do they look like beyond what you see in their mirror. You look at their car, what kind of car are they driving, what's hanging from the rearview mirror, what kind of bumper stickers do they have. So you begin to kind of formulate these ideas, which truly are labels and somewhat could be deemed as stereotypes, you know, who is this person in front of you? And so that's kind of where it all began. And then from there, I tried a few different approaches over the years as to how I wanted to create a stronger narrative with this idea. And then I came up with my current project, which, you know, is really about identifying people as individuals and kind of having that respect as you look and have a conversation with somebody and to kind of put some of those other feelings aside instead of prejudging somebody, beginning to get an understanding beyond what you see visually.
And just for the benefit of our listeners, basically you see some of people's faces in the rearview mirror, not full faces.
Correct. And
sometimes it's just eyes, basically.
Mostly eyes and the bridge of the nose for the most part.
Okay. And then on the left side of the pages, and this is the book. I mean, I don't know how it's going to be at the gallery.
It'll be the same way in the gallery. You'll have the picture of them from behind with their clothes on the left-hand side. And then on the right side will be a nude photograph with the mirrored images of their eyes covering their face. And so it's a diptych of them clothed and then them nude.
Okay. Just as I'm curious to hear your answer to this, because everyone thinks that we're pretty good judges of character. Well, I mean, some people I know would admit that they're not, but I think we all think like within 5 seconds we have a really good feel for a person. Do you think after this project, do you think that people generally do, or do we usually get it completely wrong or partially wrong?
Well, I guess it would all depend on if what kind of questions you're asking them. If you're basing it purely on a visual, I think we get it wrong most of the time. If you're actually having a conversation with them, then I think that you probably can get a better idea in a short period of time of what kind of person they are.
And that's what another aspect that we didn't talk about that I find interesting is that just about all of the pages have text. Are these something that you asked them questions and they responded to, or was this pretty, did they have pretty free rein to write their own text?
They had free rein to write their own text. I did as they left, I handed them a sheet of paper. As they left the studio, I gave them a sheet of paper with a question on it that said, what is the single most thing that you would like people to know about you that isn't necessarily apparent by your physical presence or a brief casual conversation? And so then they emailed that response back to me at a later date. And what I found interesting was as I was getting these responses back, I took the liberty of kind of deciding what image that was reflected in a rearview mirror I put over their head to be included with their nude photo. And oftentimes I really found I felt I was quite accurate in interpreting based on just my own interaction with them during the photo session that what they ended up saying in their statement and how I kind of put their image together had a really strong connection and relationship. So I think I feel like I did a really good job of listening to them while they were in the photo studio as we were having conversations and then just paying attention to their body language as I was taking their pictures. And then it was actually a real pleasant surprise when I would get their statements back that I felt I was being as true as I could be to the whole experience of having done the photo shoot and then matching it up to their statement.
Did you have a say in the selection of poses or clothes in the clothes photographs?
The clothes, what I asked them to do is to just wear what they would normally wear or how they wanted to be represented. So I did not choose, you know, any kind of wardrobe that they would wear. That was completely up to them. The posing, both clothed and nude, I didn't want to direct it at all. And as a commercial photographer, I tend to direct everything extremely to the, you know, minute detail. So there were times where you would look at a photo when they were in front of you and it would be like, oh, if they would just swing their hip a little bit to the right, what a great picture that would be. And I didn't want to influence the photograph. I wanted them to react and make it completely their own. So the only part that I really directed was having the reflected image of their eyes in the mirror, in the rearview mirror. I just actually asked everybody to kind of look left, right, up, and down. So I kind of had a variety of looks to choose from that I could then match to the body image that they chose.
It's astounding to me just how much personality comes off of these photographs. And for me, just my personal take on it was the clothed photographs, way more personality, but perhaps that's because clothing is a reflection of our personalities. And the nude ones still had some personality in them, but less so. What did you think about that?
Well, I think they had personality, but it almost became, I think the clothes, just as the mirror is kind of a mask in this case, clothes to most of us, it represents a sort of a mask or how you want to be represented. So when it came to doing the nude photograph, which was the last part of the process during the shooting session, you know, they just didn't have any of that, those barriers left anymore. And as you look through the catalog and read some of the statements, and then based on some of the personal conversations that I had with them, you began to really kind of see a lot more of their inward personality and the vulnerabilities that they had. And that came across oftentimes in how they decided to pose, which was, again, completely up to them, how they wanted to represent themselves. So I guess when I look at it, I see it, I think they both have value and personality, but I think one is definitely more of an external kind of view as with their clothes on, and then the other one becomes a much more emotional kind of posing. So I think it's accurate to say that they both have equal personality, just kind of in different ways.
And I think at least two of them, or maybe three in their statements said, I appear to be confident on the outside, but on the inside, I'm really not. I'm still struggling with identity issues.
Exactly. And what I found interesting was, you know, there was one gentleman that I photographed that, you know, me being a short and a stout person physically, I would be the type of person that would look at this individual and he's tall and he had a good physique. And you're like, wow, you know, how awesome that must be to kind of have that kind of look. And here was a gentleman that was very insecure about how he looked, and yet, you know, somebody who may not have his looks looks at him with a certain sense of wanting to almost have that kind of physique. And so just because you look a certain way doesn't mean that you necessarily carry that confidence that other people might assume goes with it.
Why did you choose to do this all in black and white?
Well, I think that the colors distract a little bit from just kind of looking at the shape and the form. So I kind of wanted to take that away from the viewer. And a lot of the work that I do just tends to be in black and white. So it's kind of the genre that I prefer to work in. And I do some color work, but I just felt that it would just kind of, again, strip away some of those external kind of things and make you look a little bit harder at the individual. And then also, it does allow you to kind of make your own interpretations and decisions, again, which can become more label type of things and stereotypes. But I wanted to kind of give the viewer the opportunity to kind of look at it and say, well, that could be me, you know, that could be my friend, and just kind of build their own story around who these people might be.
Now, there's quite a few subjects in the book anyway. Were there more people that you narrowed it down to, the ones that you represented in the book, or were these the people that you chose and they're the ones you stuck with?
You know, when I first started the project, I had no idea how many people I would get to volunteer to be in this. And so my goal was to have 25 individuals, and I ended up with 33. And so everyone that is in the book or the catalog, I did, you know, are all of the people that I photographed. For the gallery exhibition, space limitations only allow me to put 19 of the people into the show. But what I found interesting, since I didn't try to pick and choose necessarily who ended up being in the series, I ended up with 19 women and 14 men who volunteered to be in this series. And so when I show the 19 images, I wanted to keep that ratio, because I felt there's some information there as well that we can kind of look at, you know, as to identity. And I think, you know, this is me just kind of putting my own perception on it, but I think that women definitely have a much more difficult time with identity than most men do, even though I do believe, having done this series, that men have their own experiences and insecurities as well.
Would you say this is mainly related to our self-image or body image?
I think it's both, because I think as our self-image, that's kind of the clothed individual, and that's the perception, and that's how people see us in public and in most of our daily lives. And then the nude part, I think, becomes more of that emotional and that private moment. But yet they're all related. And when you get up in the morning and you look in the mirror, you kind of judge yourself, you know, and you judge it based on other people you know and things you see on TV and what you see in the magazines. And there are all these, you know, expectations put upon all of us about what, you know, maybe we should look like, or what's the perfect body, or, you know, all these different things. If you're a businessman, maybe you shouldn't have so many tattoos and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, I think we, you know, all that information is just always present in our minds. And so when you're looking at yourself in the mirror, you're also judging yourself based on all these external factors.
Well, it was very interesting to look and read. William Zubik, thank you very much for coming on Lake Effect.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Photographer William Zubik's exhibit is called Identity. It runs Saturdays through November 16th at the Frank Juarez Gallery in Sheboygan. He spoke with Dan Harmon, and you can find links to more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Next on the program, one Enophile's journey into podcasting. Ray Pfister joins us on a special anniversary when we return on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. For those of you who just can't get enough of Lake Effect wine contributor Ray Pfister on this program, you can always hear him interviewing some of the country's top winemakers on his podcast, Life Between the Vines. Pfister just celebrated the podcast's 100th episode, and he came to the Lake Effect studios to celebrate the milestone and pop the proverbial cork. Pfister tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce about how the podcast and his own appreciation for the wine industry have evolved.
I don't drink wine the same way. I don't see it the same way. Now that I know what these people go through, what they deal with, from Mother Nature to what could happen in the cellar, I have such different appreciation for it. For me, I've learned the fine art of making wine, how everybody has their own technique, yet they're all doing the same thing, and how each one of them has this incredible passion. Again, for people to understand that during harvest, which is going on now, these people are doing 15, 17-hour days, 7 days a week. There's no break. They cram lunch in when they can, and they're taking care of their babies. And that'll continue on for a while because you get the whites first, then the reds, then the late harvest. It's continual work, and it's fast, and it moves along at a crazy pace.
Now, you've gotten to interview so many different winemakers over the years. What have been some of your favorite stories that you've heard?
I think it's more just hearing them tell them than it is picking out one individual story. Meeting Mike Gergich of Gergich Hills, and Mike Gergich made the Chardonnay that's well known from the movie Bottle Shock and which won the Tasting of Paris in 1976. Such a great guy. He just turned 90 this year, and he's still kicking, and he's still out there in the cellar. You know, and, meeting him was a true honor. Meeting Carissa Mondavi, Robert Mondavi's granddaughter, who is just a beautiful, very, very nice woman, great to talk to, and her dad, Tim, just to be around the Mondavi family. I mean, they are the rock stars of the wine business. But yet meeting a lot of these smaller winemakers, Amy Aiken, and now her husband Joel, who has his own label, which is called Aiken. I just saw in a new issue of Wine Spectator, Karen Cakebread's Pinot Noir got very high rating, and it's like your friend. It's really quite a thrill to talk to these people and see what they put into this.
What trends have you seen as you've done these 100 podcasts?
You know, wines come and go. Malbec has had a major, has become somewhat of a fashionable wine over the last couple of years. And it's great, too, because people are knowing they can buy it fairly inexpensively. Argentinian wine is great wine. That's come along nicely. Ever since Sideways, Pinot Noir has kind of been king. And if you talk to any winemaker, they would say that it belongs in that chair because Pinot is considered the most complex, amazing wine that people can drink. Everybody has their own opinion, but Pinot is sort of reigning right now. Zinfandel is kind of making a comeback. People are starting to pay attention to this very complex and difficult to grow grape. So there are these trends and then mini trends. I think one of the things I've learned personally is I've learned to open my mind, and I always tell people, now, don't be closed-minded about anything. I've never drank sparkling wine, champagne, if you will. Never had an interest in it. In the last 2 years, whenever I have friends over, I start with sparkling wine. There's a couple of labels I love. I will crack open right away. I go to a rosé if I can because I want to start light and then go into my Cabernet or to my Petit Syrah or whatever. I think that's the thing is try, learn.
What are some of the things you've heard from fans listening to the podcast over the years? How have their questions and feedback changed?
I don't think anything's really changed. They're just more curious about, well, can you, we'd like to see more stories from Australia. We'd like to see some more from Italy, that kind of thing. We just got an invitation from a chateau in France to come see them, which, of course, I'd love to do. So we're seeing more of that kind of thing going on.
Do you see then that maybe wine is becoming a little more egalitarian, if you will, that it's not quite so elitist as many people used to think that it was with the, you know, let me try to find the notes of nut and whatever.
I think it is becoming more for the common man, the common person. There'll always be an elite section of wine. Those are the people who go to the auctions and try and buy the fine bottles. Even that's getting a little funny now because there's been issues with fraud. So people are being much more careful about how they buy. But I see all kinds of people in the store, in the wine stores I go to, buying everybody. I mean, tall, fat, short, you know, different colors. I mean, it's just because they're looking for something interesting and different. And maybe they want to turn their friend on to it when they try it, going, hey, this is pretty good.
So how are you celebrating the 100th podcast?
I'm going to crack a bottle of wine.
Well, what about the podcast itself?
What will we hear? What we're going to do is for the last couple of years, I've been accruing a collection of what I call words of the winemakers, and you and I have talked about this in the past, where, you know, you can't swing a dead cat, if you will, and not hit a glossary of wine online or in a book or whatever. And those glossaries tend to be very textbookish and kind of boring. So my thought was, I'm just going to ask a winemaker, tell me your definition of terroir. Tell me your definition of clone, or just the varietal itself, Cabernet Sauvignon. What, you know, how would you define that? So that's what we've done. There's 21 winemakers from Napa, Sonoma, Santa Barbara County, San Jose, from Italy, from Wisconsin, and from Oregon, giving us their definition of all of these wine words. And it's fun because some of them are words you wouldn't expect, and some, of course, are very common words.
Well, we have a little sampling here. What's a surprising word that you're going to feature today?
I don't know if it's a surprising word, but it's my favorite. It's the lees or surlees, which is basically the sediment you'll find in a Chardonnay barrel that winemakers will stir into the wine as it ages. And having done that myself, it's kind of cool. It's especially cool to see it when the wine has settled in a larger tank and how they use that to help age the wine and give it different notes. And that definition is given to us by Brooks Painter of Castello di Amoroso, which is a castle, if you will, in Napa Valley, a genuine castle. It's pretty cool. He's a neat guy.
Surlees is the French phrase for meaning aging the wine on those solids and on those lees. Generally, as I said, it's composed of dead yeast cells. And as the wine remains in contact for a period of time on the lees, those yeast cells, as they age and start to decompose, they actually release various compounds into the wine, specifically some things called mannoproteins. And this will change the texture and the mouthfeel of the wine. It will add more volume.
So that was the definition of surlees. What about native fermentation? Who will define this for us?
That would be defined by Craig Hazarow. Craig is the owner, or co-owner, I should say, of Sojourn Cellars, located just off the square in Sonoma. A really great guy, fun interview, and listen to his voice. I think he sounds like Jeff Bridges.
So in the winemaking process, we are effectively taking grapes that are about 25% sugar, and we are going to take those grapes and make them 0% sugar. And in the process of the fermentation, the alcohol, sugar is going to get converted to alcohol, and the alcohol is going to go from about 0 to about 14%.
That, again, was the definition of native fermentation, explained by Craig Hazarow. Where does a word like biodynamic come in, which is another word that we're going to hear defined today? It seems like it's referring to sustainability, environmental practices here.
It goes a little beyond that because it's almost it's a practice. It's almost to a degree of faith. There are some pretty strange parts to it if you read up on it, and some of the wine folks out there knowing what I'm talking about, where you do some funny sort of things, a little bit like burying something in the ground. And it's really interesting. But what it really comes down to is being sustainable. Many winemakers have this idea of that they're just guardians of the land for now. Eventually, someone else is going to come along and going to have to take that land after them and take care of it. And the idea is to sort of look forward and always be good to the land, not to use pesticides, to use natural ways of growing the grapes. I mean, as an example, and I'm not sure how accurate I'm being here, I remember one winemaker was talking about having, you know, their naturally beetles in a typical vineyard that's just overgrowing. They don't go in and cut the overgrowth anymore. They let it grow. So beetles get in there. Well, beetles are bad for the vines, but they bring in native spiders, and the spiders eat the beetles. And it just kind of goes through the whole chain of life. But it goes beyond that with biodynamics. It's also about the water used on the property. The woman who gives us the definition is Lynn Grace of Wiseacre Vineyard. And Lynn's amazing, and her husband is an expert on biodynamics. Their property is a half acre. There's not much to it, but they're really focused on living off the land. They are true farmers. They have goats there. They raise everything themselves and pretty much live off their own land. So they're really the truest of farmers, I guess you'd say. But they believe in this idea of taking care of this land. So when they're finished, someone else will come along and they'll get good land to work with.
It would be, in a nutshell, harnessing the energy of your particular piece of property or enhancing that energy, bringing it together, farming with intent. If you are farming biodynamically and organically, if you're farming that way, you're going to produce a better grape because there is so much intention involved.
So, Ray, our final word is, you always give one that I cannot pronounce. I'm going to try it here. Vinifera?
Yeah, exactly. Vinifera. It's basically the grapes that came from France that started it all. Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Chardonnay, that sort of thing. Steve will tell you what the actual word is. It's a phrase, a textbook Latin definition, but that is what they are classified as. Those are what their actual name is as a plant.
It's really what is known as the European both wine grapes and table grapes, actually. So certainly if you think of anything planted in Europe or California, Oregon, Washington, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, all of those grapes are vinifera.
Well, that was vinifera, as it defined by Steve Fennell of Sanford Winery. Well, Ray, what's next for Life Between the Vines?
I like to think as much diversity as we can possibly do. Coming up now, though, will be Tony Turlato, who we interviewed a few years ago, and he is the president of Turlato Wines International, which is a giant company that owns several wineries. And although we try and stay away from companies that get too big, what I like about Tony is that he lets these wineries that he works with be autonomous. They do their own thing. And these winemakers are left to be creative and to really, you know, make the best out of what they do. So Tony's always a fun interview. Plus, I was lucky enough to be invited to join them for lunch. And this is at the old Armor Mansion in Lake Bluff. So it wasn't too bad of a day. On top of that, we have an interview coming from a winery called Ten Acre, which I'm looking forward to. Very, very small place over in Sonoma. But I want to get some more French, Italian. I'd like to get some folks from Georgia because of their history of 8,000 years of winemaking there. So I really want to explore these other areas as well as Australia and some of the lesser known areas of the United States. I want to get to Virginia. Part of it is we need to remove some of our prejudices of thinking that certain areas create the best wines. If you go to a wine tasting in, I don't know, Georgia, it's going to be about the people you're with and the fun you have. It may not be, you know, Mouton Rothschild, but it's going to be probably good, and you're probably going to have a good time. And remember that.
Ray Pfister, thank you so much, and congratulations.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Our wine contributor, Ray Pfister, runs the wine blog and podcast Life Between the Vines, where you can hear his recent 100th podcast episode. Pfister also owns Fifth Floor Recording in Milwaukee's Third Ward, and he spoke with Stephanie Lecce. Just in time for the World Series, a Milwaukee writer profiles 50 Red Sox fans from around the country, 51 if you include himself. We'll meet Greg Pearson when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. The first pitch of the 2013 World Series is scheduled for this evening at Fenway Park in Boston. The Red Sox will take on the St. Louis Cardinals. Brewers fans don't necessarily have a rooting interest in the series, except that the Cardinals are a National League Central Division rival. But it is an exciting time for the members of Red Sox Nation, of which there are many in the Milwaukee area, me, for example. Also, Greg Pearson, author of the book Fenway Fanatics, 50 Boston Red Sox Fans Tell Their Stories. Pearson profiles Sox fans around the world from New England to Uzbekistan. He joined us over the summer when the Red Sox beards were still under control and when making the World Series was not yet a given. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
So this is the question that I suspect a lot of people who have grown up in this part of the world have. What is the difference, if there is any, between being a lifelong Red Sox fan and a lifelong fan of practically any other team, like say the Brewers?
Well, I think one thing with the Red Sox is they go back 110 years. And so you get generation after generation that's rooted for this team through good and bad. There was a lot of bad there from 1920 to 1970 or so. But the fans will pass this on from generation to generation. One thing in my book that came up time and again were people getting talked to by their grandfather or their father or their mother saying, you know, root for this team, but don't have too many high expectations. You know, we don't know what will happen, but it probably won't be good. But I think, you know, there was understanding if children are rooting for other teams. You know, one dad talked about how his son started rooting for the Toronto Blue Jays because he liked the logo. And when it went on for a couple of years, the dad started to get a little nervous. But eventually the son came around to the dad's way of thinking on what team he was rooting for. I think this book could be written about any team, you know, but I do think the Red Sox have that special connection with generations, you know, six state region that pretty much roots just for this one team. Obviously, there are exceptions as you get closer to the New York border and into upstate New England. There used to be folks that actually rooted for Montreal when they had a team, and Toronto has some fans up that way as well. But the whole region seems to pull for the Red Sox, and it really makes it kind of one big community when it comes to the baseball season, which I think is a little unusual. You know, obviously the New England states are a little small, which adds to that effect.
There also seems to be something distinct about the attitude of Red Sox fans towards their team. I remember there was a Dave Barry book. It was like his guide to the 50 states. He describes people from Massachusetts, and he says the two distinctions of Massachusetts people are having funny accents and expecting the Red Sox to screw up. there is a sense of foreboding when you are a Red Sox fan that does not necessarily exist when you're a Brewers fan.
I think some of that is true. The Red Sox certainly had many prime examples of kind of blowing it in the clutch, some terrible losses, some just heartbreaking, excruciating losses. And Red Sox fans can be pretty self-involved that way too. I think we like to talk about all our past failings. And you know, when they won it all in 2004 and again in 2007, some of that faded. Some fans will still talk in those old-fashioned ways of, you know, oh, we're going to blow it, we're going to lose it. And but I think it's toned down a bit, but certainly there were some reasons to feel that way along the way. And one of the dads I talked to in the book talked about watching the 2007 World Series with his son, and their views of it were just the opposite. You know, the son said, "Oh, we're going to win. You know, we just won 3 years ago," and the dad was like, "No, we're going to blow it. We're going to blow it."
It does not work this way,
right?
Well, why did you want to write this book? You are a Red Sox fan, and you include some of your own memories in this book, but mostly you are capturing other people's memories. Why was this the story you wanted to tell?
I just, as a kid growing up, I always was struck by how many folks in New England cared about this team, and I knew these stories were out there, and I just thought it would be fun to pull them all together. And one thing I tried to do is not make it too much of fans talking about, woe is me, you know, the Red Sox are going to blow it, because I think that gets a little tired for everybody to hear. But I just think some of these family stories are really touching and wonderful, funny, sad. One of my favorite chapters in the book is a woman named Jean DeRoche, who is from the Boston area, and she actually died 3 years ago. But I found out about her I was on the internet one day doing some research for the book, and I stumbled across her obit. And her obit starts out, "Wicked big Red Sox fan, attended 56 consecutive opening days." And I thought, well, that's a pretty good lead. And I read through this, and throughout her obit, it referenced the Red Sox and other Boston teams as well. And at the very end, she talked about how for her wake, she wanted people to come dressed in Red Sox apparel. And people did. And I just thought that was so wonderful. I looked at the survivors listed in her obit, found her daughter, found the name, called her right away. She was out walking her dog, and she was just thrilled to talk about her mom. And, you know, her mom was one of these fans that just never gave up, never lost hope, didn't ever flinch on this team at all. And I thought for someone who, you know, followed this team for 65, 70 years before she died in her mid-80s, I think that was remarkable. And she was a wonderful story and one of those people I wish I could have known in life.
Well, let's talk about your own experiences for just a few moments. What were the formative moments that cemented you as a Red Sox fan?
Well, I'm 58, pushing 59, and so I've been doing this for a long time with this team. And I think really anybody my age, they're going to start talking, first of all, about 1967, you know, which was the season where when I first started rooting for the Red Sox, they were terrible. And as I said in the book, I'm really not sure what attracted me. What was the reason I started rooting for these losers? But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they just got good. I mean, nobody expected it. There were no real major changes in the team. It was just they had a new manager. A couple of young players came in and really played well. A couple of older players that they'd had for a while suddenly found it. And then Carl Yastrzemski was always a good player with the team, but he was spectacular in 67. And they just had this crazy season where they won games they had no business winning. And it was a five-team race throughout most of the summer.
One of the things that really strikes me in this collection of remembrances, really, of Red Sox of the past and you know, these profiles of fans, is how many of the Red Sox fans you found had no natural connection to New England or the Red Sox, but somehow got themselves swept up in Red Sox Nation, if you will. There's a guy from Ukraine
who more or less arbitrarily took on the Red Sox?
Well, he got hooked on the Red Sox through video games and Stephen King novels. So it's a different kind of combination to get there. But he knew of King's writing, and through that he found out about King's love for the Red Sox. King wrote a book called The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon.
Which, who was a Red Sox relief pitcher.
Correct. And there were many references in that book to the Red Sox and Tom Gordon's role in the whole bit. The girl, I think, was from Maine in the book and got lost in the woods, and she used Gordon as kind of her goal to get out of the woods. You know, he was the guy that was protecting her and saving her through the night when she was out there by herself. So it's a wonderful story. But he read that, and that just got him even more into this whole Red Sox thing. And he started getting videos and, you know, got some kind of cable TV package that you can get in Ukraine to watch Red Sox baseball. And he's a diehard fan. He has a blog he does in Russian about baseball. And there's another family from Alaska, Anchorage, Alaska, Bill and John Opinski, who I interviewed both of them. Their dad had moved from Scranton, Pennsylvania as a teen, you know, right out of high school. He decided to go to Alaska and find his way there.
And at the time, there had been a Red Sox farm team in Scranton.
Right. And that was the dad's attraction to the Red Sox. You know, he was seeing former or future Red Sox players play in Scranton. And once they made the big leagues, he was, you know, as many of us do when we go to minor league games, thinking, oh, yeah, that guy, I remember seeing him 5 years ago in, you know, Scranton.
Not that this wouldn't necessarily be the case for Miller Park or for, I don't know, Kauffman Stadium or the ballpark at Arlington. But, you know, you have people – there's a guy that you profile in northern Vermont who has built a Fenway Park wiffle ball stadium in his yard.
Correct. It's a one-quarter scale of Fenway Park, and it's got the left field wall, and it's got the foul poles and the – retired Red Sox numbers hanging in right field. It really looks very authentic. There are a couple of pictures of it in the book. And one thing I did find many times over were that people, as much as they loved the team, it was the ballpark that first got them hooked. You know, they came to the park and just thought, this is a special kind of place. And, you know, Miller Park is a great place to see a game. You know, there's no doubt about it. You go in there, you can see wonderful sight lines, and it's a terrific place to see a game. And there are some things with Fenway that are not as attractive. You know, the seats are not always very comfortable, and you can be sitting out in right field facing the right fielder. So you have to turn your neck far to the left to watch the action at home plate. But there's that charm of something that's been there for 101 years now, you know, and you sit there and you think, you know, geez, Babe Ruth played here. That doesn't happen at many parks anymore these days. Wrigley and Fenway are the only two that go back that far now.
Well, Greg Pearson, thanks so much, and keep the faith.
You too, Mitch. Thank you.
Greg Pearson is the author of Fenway Fanatics, 50 Boston Red Sox Fans Tell Their Stories. Pearson lives in Wauwatosa. He's a copy editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Game one of the World Series is scheduled for tonight in Boston. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.